way eastward to Africa and Europe. The impacts of this digital Silk Road can potentially surpass the vast influence of the connectivity network on the ground or the seas, because the future is digital. China is fast becoming the global leader of cutting-edge technologies, and nothing seems to be able to stop it, not even a global disaster. When the COVID pandemic started to negatively affect some of the BRI projects, such as a $6.8 billion railway project in Pakistan, Beijing moved to speed up the digital aspect of the project, stepping up the development of the communications infrastructure. For all the partner countries along the way, the Digital Silk Road means higher quality in telecommunication with significantly lower costs, as well as more employment opportunities and technology transfer. However, there are some state and private players who are getting more and more frightened of the looming evolutionary leaps in cybersphere.
Forging the Digital Silk Road forward, China is bringing technology and additional benefits to participating countries by establishing training centers and R&D programs to boost cooperation between scientists and engineers in these countries and with their Chinese counterparts. Chinese firms are exporting know-how in areas such as telecommunications networks, artificial intelligence, e-commerce, cloud computing, smart cities, robotics, and clean energy, among others. So, who is against this project? Who doesn't want a better connected Eastern Bloc with China as its binding glue?
Since Beijing launched the Digital Silk Road DSR in 2015, it has increasingly become a substantial part of the overall strategy of the Belt and Road Initiative. Via the project, China provides economic support and technological assistance to recipient states. Observers see this as a strategic move to circumvent international telecommunication consortiums that are dominated by Western and Indian companies. The Hengtong Group, one of China's leading fiber optic and power cable makers, is heading a consortium of telecom companies from Africa, Pakistan, and Hong Kong to install the Pakistan East Africa Connecting Europe, or Peace Cable, in the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean. The laying of sea cable in Pakistan's territorial waters is scheduled to begin in March, following government approval of CyberNet, a local internet service provider, to construct an Arabian Sea landing station in Karachi. The Mediterranean section of the cable is already being laid from Egypt to France, and the 15,000-kilometer-long cable is expected to go into service later this year.
Okay, so for further insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Mike Billington. He's an executive at the Intelligence Review. Mr. Billington, welcome to this show. So, when China makes the digital road operational, it may be the end of the Western hegemony over the cyberspace. What is it that the United States is doing to topple this project?
Well, the most obvious is that under the last administration, under Mike Pompeo and his fanatic friends, they succeeded in breaking Donald Trump's effort to have a good relationship with China once they resolved the trade deal, and they were able to implement these vile, illegal attacks on Huawei and TikTok and other technologies coming out of China. So the Pompeo went around the world to basically browbeat countries into breaking from altogether and not using Chinese technology under threat of economic sanctions, under threat of isolation. So, you know, we'll see what happens with Biden. Biden, despite being a fanatic about shutting down the industrial infrastructure with this crazy Green New Deal, he has shown some signs that he wants to reestablish decent ties with China. He lifted the ban on TikTok. He lifted the effort to shut down WeChat. He hasn't said anything about Huawei yet, and he hasn't moved to release the daughter of the head of Huawei from this insane and illegal incarceration up in Canada. But these are things he could do, should do. He correctly identified after his two-hour call with Xi Jinping that China's main concern is that every time they have allowed internal disunity, they've been attacked by foreign forces, like the British Opium Wars and related things. So he recognizes that Xi Jinping needs to keep the country united, and he said he would not, Biden said he would not allow things to get back to these warring blocks from the Cold War days. We'll see if he lives up to it. He has to deal with a military-industrial complex, which even Trump was unable to overcome when he wanted to end the endless wars around the world. So it's a very dangerous moment, but we have to give him the benefit of the doubt that he's going to try to move towards cooperation with China, including dropping this crazy attack on Huawei and other IT.
Okay, so China has increased efforts and investments in the Digital Silk Road Project since COVID pandemic and economic problems have slowed down or even stopped China's progress in railroad and highway projects. Do you see a stop to this? And what role do you see of the U.S. administration in this regard?
I'm not sure that there's a stopping of the rail and road developments. Obviously, the pandemic and the lockdowns caused some problems. But I think the main reason we saw a slowing down of the infrastructure investments was because of the threatening war with the United States under Pompeo. So we'll see how this proceeds. I don't think there's any, like I said, other than the browbeating from the Pompeo and Christopher Wray types against other nations to not use Chinese technology. Other than that, I don't see anything that would stand in their way. It's well known that they have the best technology and by far the cheaper costs for most of this IT, and most countries are in great demand for this quality of work. It doesn't mean not working with the U.S. side of these things. China has never done what Pompeo's crowd did here and demand that people only work with China and not work with the U.S. and Europe. So I don't expect they will make those kinds of demands. And the only thing that could hold people back would be either real competition in the sense of better quality goods coming from the West, or the kind of, outright attack from the Pompeo types. And we're not clear yet which direction Biden's going to go on this thing. He's made some positive steps. He's also allowed the same line to come out of his cabinet that came out of the Trump cabinet about China is our adversary and their malign activities and their human rights violations and all these lies that were concocted as part of this McCarthyite witch hunt, racist witch hunt against the Chinese. So we'll see how this proceeds. The LaRouche organization is going to fight like hell to break through this anti-China hysteria amongst the population here and around the world, and to make it clear that if we don't get the U.S. and Russia and China working together to deal with the global economic crisis, the global pandemic, and all other global problems, that we're heading for a very, very dangerous situation, including the potential of a nuclear war.
Thank you so much, Mr. Billington, for being with us on our show. It was nice having you here. We've collected some social media coverages in this regard, and please stay with us.
Hua Chengying wrote on Twitter, "Since last year, the pandemic has affected the world in many respects. Yet despite the headwinds, Belt and Road Cooperation, BRI, has not paused, but forged ahead with new outcomes, strong resilience and great vitality." Stefan Horvath posted on his Twitter, "The initial focus of the Silk Road has been infrastructure investment, education, construction materials, railway and highway, automobile, real estate, power grid and commodities." Hypergrowth wrote on Twitter, "21st century Silk Road, China has emerged from exporting silk, porcelain, tea and other products to high-end and new technologies such as AI, AIOT, fintech and intelligent manufacturing." Laurie Lay Claire believes China's policies for trade, economics and technology far outshine the floundering USA, and with this new Silk Road, China will no longer need the US for trade. Trump trumped us all. You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Brain drain in India used to be an only small problem. But now, India's future is increasingly threatened by its severe case of wealth outflow, the emigration of the country's millionaires, or the so-called high-net-worth Indians. A large cut of India's GDP leaves the country every year. Considering the huge impact of this departure of human capital on the country's social and economic structure, the government may need to be faster on measures to reverse or at least reduce the figures.
It is a normal malady of the capitalist world that people accrue wealth in their home countries, then no longer feel fit for their society and move to another part of the globe, presumably for a better life. But wealthy Indians are on top of the list of those who leave their country through different investment programs. During the past 14 years, over 60,000 Indian millionaires have left the country, and in 2020 alone, more Indians than any country made inquiries for residence by investment or citizenship by investment programs. This shows a 63% rise compared with the figure of 2019. The 2020 Global Wealth Migration Review, issued in collaboration with the New World Wealth, found that in 2019, India had the second biggest wealth outflow after China. Investment-linked migration is not cheap, ranging from half to $1 million in average, but sometimes the price is more than money. Since India does not permit dual citizenship, opting for citizenship by investment means giving up the Indian passport. Almost all of these affluent Indians had already had lavish fantasy-like lifestyles. So what's wrong at home that can justify such a price? For any moves to address the issue, Indian authorities and policy makers may have to explore the thought process and reasons behind such a trade-off.
The richest Indians, who reportedly have been getting even richer despite the global chain of all the unfortunate events following the COVID-19 pandemic, are moving towards what is often called the developed nations. The top destinations for Indian millionaires are usually England, the US, Australia, the UAE, and Singapore. However, there are new favorites among Indians with deep pockets too.
Wealthy Indians aspire to migrate abroad over various reasons, from better employment opportunities to ease of doing business, from security concerns to better conditions of living and education. In addition to all-time favorite destinations, the top investment-linked residence and citizenship programs that Indians inquired about in 2020 were for residency for Canada, Portugal, Austria, Malta, and Turkey, as well as New Zealand, each for different reasons. Europe, for instance, is mentioned as the target of those who want to obtain better mobility, and North America for those who prioritize a better educational future for the next generation. However, each country has diverse good and bad points. For example, the US, Australia, and England have the same language with high standards of living, while countries like the UAE and Singapore have more convenient financial structures. With the surge in high net worth Indians leaving the country, capital is going out, talents are going out, entrepreneurial chances and prospects of a prosperous economy are going out. India needs effective plans and actions, perhaps up-to-date universities and regulations to ease business are a good start.
Now, to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Uday Bhaskar, who is the Director of Society for Policy Studies. Mr. Bhaskar, welcome. So, why do Indian millionaires leave India? What are the factors behind the wealth outflow? And why did more than 5,000 millionaires leave India in the last year?
My reading is that this particular number that is being now mentioned, about 5,000 high net worth individuals, as they call, that they are choosing to leave India, represents about 2 to 3% of the total number of the high net worth individuals in India. So I want to place this in context, that while the number may be 5,000, it is about 2% of the total number of millionaires in dollar terms in India, which, if I recall right, in a 2018 study, the total number of millionaires in India was 256,000. So that is just to give you two sets of figures. Now, one reason why high net worth individuals are moving abroad is to look for better prospects, particularly for their children, because now education has become a very high priority for any parent in any part of the world. And because of the pressure of numbers, India is a young country. There are a number of young people who are knocking on the doors of the major educational institutions, whether it is the universities or the IITs, which are globally recognized, or medical schools, engineering, and so on. And clearly, the available educational capacity is not able to accommodate the aspirations of young India. And those who can afford it are looking for educational opportunities outside of India. And they generally go to countries where English is the language that is spoken. So by and large, you'll find that many of these people who are choosing to go outside of India and giving up their Indian citizenship in some cases.
All right, Mr. Bhaskar, before moving ahead, I would like you to see the media coverages in this regard, which our team has collected, and then we can move ahead. Please stay with us.
In 2020, wealthy Indians again topped the list of those making inquiries for residence by investment or citizenship by investment programs. The number of inquiries rose from 2019, said a facilitating agency. As per Global Wealth Migration Review issued by New World Wealth, a wealth intelligence firm, Indians were the second largest contingent among the millionaire category to move overseas. Nearly 7,000 wealthy Indians, comprising 2% of the HNWIs, left the country during 2019. It appears that the interest is not waning. India stands third on the list for the number of immigrants behind China and Russia. In fact, despite the ongoing Brexit issues in the United Kingdom, the outflow in India was recorded more than that in the UK, while China recorded the maximum number of migrations amid the trade war with the US. Interestingly, a large part of the outflow preferred settling in the US, Canada, and Australia, thanks to the climatic conditions, better education, universities and schools, healthcare and tax system. Nevertheless, India's total wealth is set to grow at a handsome rate in the next 10 years. The GWMR notes that India will outperform the UK and Germany in terms of wealth generation to become the fourth largest wealth market in the world by 2028. Among the cities which will drive this growth in the next 10 years are Delhi, Bangalore, and Hyderabad. Delhi would do so on the back of its well-diversified economy and strength in a number of key sectors. Bangalore on its prowess in the fields of IT and R&D, and Hyderabad on the base of its being the pharmaceutical capital of India and its many special economic zones, the report said. Many Indian billionaires such as Lakshmi Niwas Mittal, UK, Mickey Jagtiani and Sunny Vaki, Dubai, M.A. Yusuf Ali and Shamshir Vayalil, Abu Dhabi, may have taken up residency abroad and turned non-resident Indian but remained essentially Indian at heart. The list just grows, unarguably raising concerns for the government that is struggling to spread prosperity around and improve employment opportunities.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Bhaskar. So continuing now and moving forward, what are the impacts of the high rate of immigration among the Indian affluent society of the country's economy?
Well, definitely it's a kind of brain drain, because many of India's top educational institutions, particularly the IITs, that is the Indian Institute of Technology, the medical schools, the business schools, some of the engineering schools, the most, I would say, qualified, the top tier, would look abroad for better opportunities, because I think we must accept that they also get a much higher kind of, shall we say, material return, whether it is by way of salary or the way of life or long-term kind of prospects and so on, which again is a very natural kind of impulse. I think for India, this does pose, as I said, a certain challenge, because you train and educate these people within India, but yet they choose to make their lives abroad. But at the same time, you cannot prevent them, because I think that would not be correct either. So we have to find a way of attracting, retaining the Indian talent and giving them appropriate incentives. And I think the government is very, very aware of this, and they are trying to see how best to retain the Indian talent in India.
All right, that marks the end of this session. Thank you so much, Mr. Bhaskar, for being with us. We have collected some coverages of what has been going on cyberspace and social media in this regard. So please stay with us. Thank you.
Ninja Monkey believes while many in India talk of brain drain, few are actually ready to pay top dollar for top talent. Fact is, if you really want to attract the best, you'll need to put your money where your mouth is. P. Surya Kumaran posted on his Twitter, high proportion of US and Great Britain robotic surgeons are Indian. We would have a reverse brain drain problem if they went back to India. Ashish Shah wrote on his Twitter, from brain drain to brain gain, India tech boom is bringing scientists and technologists back from the West to India. Meg Updates posted on his Twitter, Indian Americans are taking over the country US. Joe Biden referring to NASA's successful mission and high numbers in his administration. Saket Kumar Chaudhary wrote on his Twitter, what is incredible in brain drain from India? Isn't this shameful that we aren't able to keep our talents with us? Sorry to say, but if you are the CEO of Gov's think tank, only God can save us.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for today. Today we covered the issues of the digital Silk Road and the emigration of Indian millionaires towards the Western countries. We'll meet next week.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafi. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, I convey all this to you, lest inordinate desires, temptations, and inducement should start influencing you, or adverse changes of times and circumstances should drag your name in the mire, or I should leave you like an untrained colt, because a young and fresh mind is like a virgin soil which allows things sown in it to grow verdantly and to bear luxuriantly. Then, I have made use of early opportunities to educate you and train you before your mind loses its freshness, before it gets hardened or warped, before you start facing life unprepared for the encounter, and before you are forced to use your decisions and discretions without gaining advantages of accumulated traditions, collected knowledge, and experiences of others. These words of advice and counsels that I give you will save you from the worry of acquiring knowledge, gathering experiences, and soliciting advice from others. Now, you can easily make use of all the knowledge which men have to acquire with great care, trouble, and patience. Things which were hidden from them, and which only experiments, experiences, and sufferings could bring to light, are now made easily available to you through these exhortations. My dear son, though the span of my life is not as that of some other people who have passed away before me, yet I took great care to study their lives. Assiduously, I went through their activities. I contemplated over their deliberations and deeds. I studied their remains, relics, and ruins. I pondered over their lives so deeply that I felt as if I have lived and worked with them from early ages of history down to our times, and I know what did them good and what brought them harm.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali,
alayhi salam. One of the great things which we learn from the truly universal persona of Imam Ali is the fact that we need to look towards and we need to find the true sources of Islamic knowledge, the true sources of Islamic wisdom. Now we find in the historical texts that the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, the Holy Prophet's companions learned the principles of religion from Imam Ali. These companions often referred to him for religious decrees, and if they were faced with problems, they would seek the solutions from Imam Ali alone. It is interesting, but we find in these very same historical texts that Imam Ali used to correct the wrong judgments publicly passed by the second caliph Umar. Now this is recorded, as I said, in Muslim history books, both in the Shia and the Sunni schools of thought. For example, there is one time when the second caliph Umar ordered a woman who was expecting a child who had committed adultery to be stoned to death. But Imam Ali was there and he told him not to execute this sentence. And so when the second caliph Umar asked him for the reason, Imam Ali said, "If this woman's sin has been proven and she has to be stoned to death, then what is the sin of the infant which is in her womb?" Subhanallah, how we find that one really must be knowledgeable and wise when passing judgments upon others. And if one is not knowledgeable enough and one is not wise enough, the judgments that one may pass can be wrong. And if they are wrong, this is a sin on our part. Imam Ali alayhi salam, truly the source of knowledge and wisdom. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us all by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
You for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger."
يوم يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي والأقدام.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet.
وأسألك الأمان يوم لا يجزي والد عن ولده ولا مولود هو جاز عن والده شيئا إن وعد الله حق.
And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
The fasting of the month of Ramadan is an important pillar of our faith. And all physically fit and mature Muslims are required to fast every day of this month of Ramadan. Fasting is not unique to Islam. It is there in Christianity, in Judaism, even in Hindu and Buddhist tradition. There is this tradition of fasting. However, in Islam, when we talk about fasting, it is more involved in a sense that every day of the month of Ramadan, we have to abstain from dawn to dusk, abstaining from food, even from drinking water, and those who are smokers are not allowed to smoke. At the end of the holy month of Ramadan, we celebrate a very important occasion, which is known as Eid al-Fitr, and this is comparable to Christmas among Christians, for example. And that day is a very major day for us, where all Muslims would gather in their mosques for a special prayer. But in our religious teachings, there is a requirement that before we even go and participate in that special prayers on Eid al-Fitr, the heads of family are required to pay a special charity on that day on behalf of themselves and their family members. That process known as, you know, paying that charity on the day of Eid is just like, you know, after going through the process of fasting for the whole month, it's as if God is now holding our hand, helping us to walk on the path of charity and sharing with others. Then maybe now that you have fasted for this long, you know the feeling of the poor and the needy people. And so this is what you have to start. Hopefully you will continue the tradition of charity. And so when we look at this tradition, you know, it has personal benefits for us on physical level, on spiritual level, but also it's a community issue. This whole sense of gathering, you know, thanks God, all families could have been sitting in their own homes and having their own iftar without any problem. But this whole spirit of community building, where in the month of Ramadan, Muslims gather in the mosque so that they can be part of the community when they break their fast, known as iftar. And, you know, very soon after the prayers, you'll be able to witness and be part of that very beautiful tradition that we have in the Muslim society.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Grateful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
There are contractors who helped torture inmates at Abu Ghraib and massacred civilians at Nisr Square. Armed mercenaries who rolled with CIA in secret. Trained troops guarded dignitaries. Many died with no mention in the papers. Came home injured and sick with none of the benefits of Pentagon healthcare. They were a shadow army, really a massive experiment in how Uncle Sam could wage war across several countries cheaper and longer by leaning on the private sector to do it, says Kelly Bicar Wallace, writer, in an article published under the heading End of an Era. Afghanistan is now graveyard of contractors too. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The golden post 9/11 years of the war contractor. The providers of food and transportation, fuel, construction, maintenance, IT, not to mention security and interrogation services for the U.S. military, appear to be drawing down. With the withdrawal of the remaining 3,600 troops in Afghanistan by September, attention is also on the nearly 17,000 contractors on the U.S. payroll there, 6,147 of whom are American citizens. The U.S. contractors will come out as we come out. That is part of the planned withdrawal we have in place right now, said CENTCOM Commander General Kenneth McKenzie in a briefing with reporters recently. Despite earlier reports that the government has numerous contracts with companies stretching far beyond the deadline to leave, it would appear the thrust of U.S. operations in Afghanistan is diminishing and the withdrawal has begun. Even if that takes a while, or the United States manages to keep some presence in the country after September 11th, the private sector footprint will never be as big as it was at its height in 2011, when there were over 90,000 contractors in Afghanistan. At times, including now, contractors outnumbered uniformed personnel. To put it into practice, there were 155,000 contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan compared to 145,000 active duty service members in 2011. Contractors made up 62% of the workforce. The money paid to contractors is even more daunting. $104 billion for services in Afghanistan alone since 2002, nearly $9 billion just in the last 5 years. With so much dependence on contractors came trouble. Huge companies like Halliburton, with subsidiaries such as KBR, took advantage. Not only were companies overcharging and caught engaging in fraud during the early salad days, but worse, they cut corners to make more money. Who could forget the flimsy, defective showers and electrical systems? Electro-cutting trips throughout Iraq, the unsafe drinking water on bases, spoiled food. Then there are the contractors who help torture inmates at Abu Ghraib. and massacred civilians at Nisour Square. Armed mercenaries who rode with CIA in secret trained troops guarded dignitaries. Many died with no mention in the papers, came home injured and sick, with none of the benefits of Pentagon healthcare or VA. They were a shadow army, really a massive experiment in how Uncle Sam could wage war across several countries cheaper and longer by leaning on the private sector to do it. But it wasn't cheaper, and the cost not just in dollars. For every positive thing contractors did in country, there is a school or a hospital or some facility that literally won't stand after they're gone. Halliburton and KBR and Blackwater are names of the past, but they got their gold. They care not about the graveyard of empires. Others like Fluor Group, which provides logistical support to the military currently in Afghanistan, are going to see an end to the lush days, and they're feeling it. The timetable to do this properly is already too tight, said David Bertu, president of the Professional Services Council, representing 400 government contractors, many working in Afghanistan. We don't have years, we have only months. All good things must come to an end, right?
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
اون نازله‌ای که از سفره معصوم و از اون میهمانی خاص خدا با معصوم به ما میرسه به کی میرسه؟ به اون کسی میرسه که اون شب
What we benefit from the banquet of Allah on the night of Qadr is equal to our recognition of the graces of Ahlul Bayt. The path towards Allah is not an easy one, and no ordinary man is able to pass it. The straight path of Allah is only one. the Holy Prophet of Islam drew some skewed lines on the ground for his companions, and then a straight one, claiming that the straight path of Allah is only one. Not every path will lead to Allah. Now, that only path goes through the valley of Allah on earth, starting with Imam Ali alayhi salam, and now available through Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajah. This is through the gate of Wilaya that we can enter the straight path towards Allah.
بنابراین اگر کسی تونست تو اون شبها که میهمان اصلی خدا ولی اللهه، اگر کسی تونست یه قدم به معصوم به این باب نزدیک بشه.
Therefore, if we can on the night of Qadr get closer to the infallible wali of Allah, then we can claim that we are close to the gate of the straight path of Allah. True recognition of the night of Qadr means this, not mere keeping vigil. Keeping vigil is a necessary condition, but not a sufficient one. A person might be awake on the night, but he may not benefit from anything. We must be awake, and we must enter the straight path of Allah through Ahlul Bayt. Now we can understand why on the night of Qadr we put Quran over our heads and seek help from Allah and the Infallibles. This is because we have to go to the straight path of Allah, and we must resort to the Quran and Ahlul Bayt. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.